Hi, everyone. It's Ryan Hoover, your host of Product Hunt Radio, where I'm joined by the founders, investors, and makers that are shaping the future of tech. Today, I'm at the headquarters of High Fidelity in San Francisco, talking with the co-founder and CEO, Philip Rosedale. Philip and the team at High Fidelity are creating free, open-source software that enables real-time social virtual reality. In fact, this episode was actually recorded entirely in VR. Philip's in a different room, wearing a headset just like I am, and we're doing this interview together with people also in VR in their avatars watching live. Check out the show note for a link to the video capture. You'll see both my avatar, which looks a little silly, and Philip's, which looks much better. Some of you may also recognize Philip as the creator of Second Life, the iconic internet-scale virtual world. So he's known a lot about this space. He's been playing in this space for quite some time. On the show, we talk about where VR is today and where it's heading in the future, including some of Philip's requests for products, how widespread adoption VR will transform work and school, and we also touch on some of the philosophical questions about VR, including how to deal with identity in a virtual world and how VR can enable better privacy online. But before we jump in, I want to give a shout out to our sponsors. Fun fact, the gorgeous 1985 Ferrari Testarossa has appreciated upward of 400% over the past 10 years, outperforming the S&P 500, most real estate, and other traditional investments. The problem is, regular investors like myself don't have a few hundred thousand dollars laying around to buy and hold these rare and expensive assets. With this realization, New York-based Rally Road built an app, you may have seen it on Product Hunt last year, so that normal folks like myself can invest in high-value alternative assets like the Ferrari for as little as $50 per share. You can even get a fancy share certificate so you can show it off to your friends. All offerings are SEC registered, and all assets are museum quality and professionally maintained by the company for long-term appreciation. Members can participate in initial offerings as well as buy and sell shares in regular trading windows for each asset, very similar to the stock market. They're starting with classic cars, but look out for their launch of the second asset class in early 2019 as they work towards democratizing alternative asset investing. Check it out at joinrally.com/producthunt.
Yeah, Ryan. Awesome. I guess, shall I say welcome, or you could welcome me to your cat cafe? I don't know where we are. Well, but, you know, that's VR for you.
Yeah, so I was asked, where do we want to host this? And I suggested, first thing that came to mind was a cat cafe, just because it sounded so ridiculous.
And there are but a lot here of cats are. In here. Yeah, for those in the studio audience and the live, I see the live cameras. The beauty of VR is you can have a camera person who is like Hal. Mm-hmm. It's like, open the pod bay door, Hal. I think that we can say hello to our live video audience there. Yeah, there's a lot of cats in here. So you want to tell me, is there...
Nice.
Were we talking about this? You give me the cat backstory or some fraction.
Well,
what is the deal with cats, Ryan?
What is the deal with cats? Well, so I did grow up with cats, but really the whole cat thing was more of an organic thing that came out from the early days of Product Hunt. The short version was we started Product Hunt really, and I can talk more about that. But initially we built this community, and one of the community members reached out and said, "Hey, I love Product Hunt. I would love to create some swag or some t-shirts, some logos, whatever." And so we started collaborating, and he created a bunch of different illustrations. Some of them were not preferred. Like, one was very aggressive. It was an arrow with, like, in a target, and I was like, that's really aggressive. And then one illustration was a cat with Google Glass. And
oh,
it was just,
right.
It was so ridiculous that I gravitated towards it, and we, you know, the community has certainly adopted cats just because the internet loves cats. That's why we're here.
And it may, and that the Google Glass may find its, you know, resting place or whatever on cats somehow, you know, some lightweight interface for the cat. I remember getting
maybe
one of the first Google Glass. Did you get one of the Google Glass glasses? I guess that's what you call them when they first came out. Or
I played with one, but I never got one myself. Did you play with it?
We got, you know, my co-founder Ryan, as opposed to you, sir. My co-founder Ryan, we got one at our office when they very first came out. And I can remember the very peculiar experience of, like, walking down the street with this thing on and feeling like the social complexity of it so outweighed the mm-hmm. technical issues, you know, that I remember going to our office on Market Street in San Francisco and challenging everybody in the office and saying, who among you will wear this thing and walk down the street like two blocks and order a sandwich?
Yeah.
And I was just like, I don't think I could do it. It feels really unusual.
Very awkward.
I just remember that being one of those, you know, like with VR and AR and all this stuff. It's like, these are, like, talk about, you know, your world looking at products. These are complicated product issues that we've got to get through, right, with VR.
Yeah. Have you played with spectacles, Snap spectacles yourself? I mean, obviously, they're very different. They're not doing anything in AR, at least not yet.
I don't have a pair. We have someone, we have, I think, maybe a couple of people here at the office who have them. So I see them on them. They feel better, right? I mean, at least you get, you know what you're getting, right? I mean, you're getting recorded, maybe, you know, putting the lights on. And so it does feel a little better, you know?
Yeah. They've actually done some really subtle, important things to address a lot of the Google Glass issues. And one you mentioned, the light itself, when you're recording, there's a light that shows. So people around you know when you're recording. But two, they also address some of the technical challenges with regards to low light filming, for example. So there's a reason why they're sunglasses and not regular glasses, at least right now. Because if you were to go around at night and try to film, it would look really bad.
See anything.
Yeah, until they improve that technology.
What a great point. I didn't know. So going back to what you said and beyond the cats, what got you into product hunting? You know, what was how'd you get there?
Yeah, so I'm assuming maybe anyone who's watching this, or at least certainly those in VR, probably are excited about new technology or playing with new products. And so I've always really been passionate about, you know, exploring technology. And I used to download a bunch of random apps. I used to browse like the Japanese app store just to see what was popular and download apps that I couldn't understand in different languages.
Now, there you go. That's a Genesis story that is truly identifying, right? How many people do you think, other than you, were downloading apps from the Japanese app store where they couldn't understand the...
Yeah, I was just incredibly curious about like what are people in Japan playing with, and what are the differences between, from a UX product perspective, like how are these apps different than ours? And they've always been really into technology, and then fast forward, you know, I had an idea of, you know, me and my friends are always sharing products, we're sharing apps, but there wasn't a place on the internet to have just a single list of here's what's new and cool today in technology. And furthermore, there wasn't a place to kind of geek out about these things with other people who are excited about tech, or, and certainly there wasn't a place to talk to the founders and the creators of these apps or these products. And so,
and isn't it interesting how it became all about the apps? Like the iPhone was a sort of a functional demo in 2007, right? It had cool capabilities. I mean, I remember looking at it saying, I could never type on this keyboard. I could never do that. That's insane. There's no way I'll type. I'm too busy. I'm doing email. I got to use my BlackBerry.
it wasn't serious, right? Because it didn't have a capable keyboard.
It wasn't serious. And then what happened, of course, which is the same thing that will happen here, meaning, you know, in VR, I think, is that the apps became what mattered, you know? And was that like 2 years, right? Maybe like 2009, right? They opened the app store to other apps like pretty early. But then there was suddenly a moment where you just knew that there was this countless universe of apps, right?
Yeah. Well, there's always some sort of breakout in different mediums or different platforms. And, you know, whether it's the Xbox launching with Halo, which if Halo didn't exist, I don't know if the Xbox would be around today. Like that was the killer app that made that successful. And then you see other successes like, you know, Serial with podcasting is one example where Serial was a rarity and it blew up. And now a lot of people are at least more aware and maybe listening to podcasts than they were a few years ago before it came around. So VR will have that too.
Here's a question for you about VR that I ask everybody and myself, my team, we all think about it, right? Which is the unit of, there's always a unit. So in worlds, in places that are largely user contributed, right? And of course that's not every product, but it's many products. It's not Halo, but you know, it's the web. The question that I'm always struck by, having seen a few of these generations, you know, going back to the original internet, you know, in 94 and then kind of the iPhone and then like something like Instagram, where the question is always, what is the unit of content that we can all contribute, right? Like with Instagram, of course, it was just a quick and easy way to use the phone, the camera that was on your phone, you know, in the most leveraged way. You know, with YouTube, what was it? It was, I don't know, playing music from your dorm room. It was this new format, right? Like when YouTube started, everybody thought it was going to be television shows, you know, or stolen television shows to start, and then new television shows. But it actually turned out to be a different format, right? And so one of the things I really wonder about in VR, and I'd love your thoughts on, is what's our format going to be? what's the unit of content that we're all going to contribute? Is it going to be ourselves, our avatars?
I don't know. But what I do find fascinating is VR, you know, it creates this immersion. Granted, the technology is relatively early, but it will get better. And eventually, with time, it will be almost indistinguishable from like the real life, at least many aspects of it.
That's our goal,
And so, I don't know, you could kind of fast forward and think through, in a future like that, what are the most interesting experiences that are currently limited to physicality of the real world? And so some of that's around travel, for example. Like right now, I would love to go, you know, back to Tulum in Mexico because it's a beautiful spot. But, you know, it's costly. I got to schedule and coordinate with friends. There's a lot that goes into moving my physical body to a different location.
Yep.
And, you know, it's a ways before you can start feeling the ocean on your face and things like that. But I think that's the most interesting aspect of VR because that enables something that people want to do genuinely. They want to go explore, travel, do interesting things in real time with friends and other people. But it's costly.
You know, one of the demonstrations that we've done that is a video on our site and that we've done a bunch of sort of test firing of is there was a capture of an Egyptian tomb, the tomb of Nefertari, that was done by a couple of guys out of Los Angeles and in conjunction with this firm called Curiosity Stream that does online learning content. And they did this really good capture of this tomb, so good that when you're inside it, and I can take you there after this, we can all go together, you see a level of detail that's, you know, definitely sufficiently good. You basically can't tell you're not there. It's looking at the walls of this tomb. And we've been doing this thing where we take an Egyptologist who's in Los Angeles, and then we bring a teacher with her students into a facility that we have down the street, and we take them all through this tomb together with this Egyptologist. And as you say, I mean, you can't do that. I mean, we basically just put those kids on an airplane, you know, to Cairo, and sort of teleported them there and brought them back at a cost of, you know, almost nothing for them to go through this experience, you know, and actually get a pretty good overview of, you know, Egyptian storytelling and tombs, you know, right there. So I agree with you. Yeah. I think one of the mistakes with VR at the outset has been trying to do casual things with it because it is by no means, as you know, sitting right now in a Vive Pro, you know, in all the setup you and I just went through, which is arduous. This existing equipment is super hard to use. So you've got to find things like that, like going to an Egyptian tomb, that are so valuable that you would do them no matter what. You know, I mean, if I told you I could take you to the moon right now with this headset, you'd be like, okay, I'm in. I got this figured out. I can get it adjusted, right? But if I told you you were going to like play a really cool video game, you know, you're going to be like, I'm busy. I mean, you know, it would have to be incredibly good. So I think that's one of the challenges VR faces right now.
Yeah, I mean, that's like next level field trips. I think education is pretty fascinating. I think particularly within the area of history, imagine if instead of reading a book, like when I was a kid, we would all together read a book about history, like U.S. history, for example, and we'd learn about World War II. And of course, there'll be some photos and there'll be words and descriptions and so on. But imagine how much more real and how much better you would remember an experience if you started to be able to experience aspects of it. If you could, you know, transport and teleport to that location at that time.
Have you ever heard of the Memory Palace? It's actually an explicit demonstration of what you just said, which is people that, you know, people, it turns out you can learn to like memorize all the phone numbers on one page of a phone book. It actually turns out that we can all be trained to do that, which is really a trip. But a number of people have written about it. It takes a while. I mean, it takes a bit of time to do it. But the way you do it, which is really cool, is you imagine a room like this one, like the Cat Cafe, and then you write in your mind, you write the phone numbers on the wall, basically. You put a phone number over there on the by the coffee cup on the table. You put a phone number on the leather couch. And that actually enables you to remember an incredibly large amount of data by embedding it in a physical memory. And so that's what it makes what you're saying so true. We actually know historically that this is how mnemonists, I think that's what you call them, mnemonists, it's how they do it. And so, yeah, you're absolutely right, right? A learning experience that's this, where we can walk around in the space, is just going to be, I don't know, you know, 10 times more retentive or something than reading in a book or seeing pictures. You know,
a lot of people are visual learners or visual memorizers, if that's a phrase.
If that's a thing, yeah.
My girlfriend, for example, she has an amazing memory. Uh-huh. And one of her ways of remembering people's names and faces is actually what they're wearing. So if you ask her, people that she knows, like what they were wearing when she first met them, a lot of times she'll remember. which is kind of wild, actually, because it's not something that I register myself. I never think about that.
These different learning styles will probably definitely be sort of segmented and amplified in here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, really interesting stuff.
How are you seeing people, what are people creating in this world? And are there patterns of types of things that people are creating?
There's kind of like, I don't know, I would kind of break it into three groups. One is obviously avatars, just like what you see with the robot there or our flying camera person. You can make an avatar in almost anything and then sort of animate it with your motions. So there's a lot of play in that, you know, anything from a dragon that has a working tail, you know, where you can, you know, walk around and your tail works, you know, follows you, to photo scan people like us. So that's one category. And then another one is spaces like this, where people are taking really two different kinds of source material. One is a modeled room like this one. So this room was built for you. And so it was modeled. So most of the stuff in this room is basically like uploaded from a 3D object. And we can import stuff like places like Sketchfab or Google's Poly. We can take content directly in from there. And so you can basically download a couch and stick it in the room and it just works. There's another way to capture whole rooms, though, which is what I mentioned with the tomb. And that's this deal, you know, where you take a camera and you take 1,000 pictures of the room and then you feed it into a piece of software. And the software extracts a 3D model from all the images and lights it and everything for you. So that's another way. That's what happened with the tomb, for example. So we're sort of seeing things happening in those areas. And then the third category is stuff like a car, or there's a guy in our community who made these grappling hooks that you load up and you put them on, and then you point and shoot at the wall, and like Spider-Man, you know, it throws a web and then pulls you over that way. So, you know, that's actually one of the people. We just started enabling people to make money from the things that they build in here using our cryptocurrency. And the first few, you know, thousands of dollars that have been taken out by content creators have already happened. And among them, you know, have been people like this guy who was making the Spider-Man, you know, computer things. So I think there's a lot of experimentation to come, if Second Life is any indication, in just playing with the medium and trying to come up with stuff that really, you know, works. And and then hopefully letting market forces in the way of currency basically drive optimization in the same way that I guess advertising, I don't know, on YouTube, you know, has driven
capitalism.
A lot of format discovery. Yeah, or capitalism writ large.
Yeah. How far out from, are we able to stitch together standard photos that people take with their iPhone across the world? Of course, if you go to certain places, especially touristy locations, you have basically infinite number of photos on the internet and at different angles. Are we able to stitch that together and then recreate that world programmatically?
You know, there's a challenge, I think, in pooling all the data, and then there's a normalization of normalizing the color and the lighting, which is a real problem. Just like what you see with Google Street View, you know, you're going around there, and sometimes the lighting changes pretty harshly because they just switched to a photo set that was an overshot at a different time of day or something. There's a similar problem, but basically the answer is, yeah, there's some really good stitching programs out there. Like Microsoft has one, and then there's a program that came out of Russia, I believe, that's amazing. That's kind of the gold standard today. Somebody can tell me if they think of the name, but there's a bunch of programs that do that pretty well. And I mean, I think the idea is, the question is just like, how do we pull all those tourist photos together, like legally in one place? And then maybe another question is, who owns that resulting work? Do we all own it?
Right.
You know, is that kind of public property? That's
right.
An interesting question too, I think. But it can be done.
Yeah. I mean, I think the future where we can do that also in real time, if we're wearing something like a future Google Glass that's recording 24/7. I mean, this is getting into Black Mirror kind of weird territory, but being able to, it is an amazing series, a little too close to home perhaps for some people, but there'll be a future there, which is pretty exciting and kind of scary.
One of the things we think about a lot here at High Fidelity is how identity, privacy, and reputation is going to work. Because if you think about it, virtual worlds are very interesting in that they put in a very big spotlight, these issues around privacy, anonymity, freedom of speech. I believe it is an obvious statement that we are not going to be Philip Rosedale and Ryan Hoover. We're not going to have our like name tags floating over our heads in VR when we're wandering around from place to place in tombs and, you know, cities and stuff. That's not going to work, because we wouldn't want that. You know, we wouldn't want to be traceable in that way. So, but how we balance how much identity we disclose against the needs of society, right? Like if you're a jerk to me, you know, if we meet in a virtual nightclub and you're just hanging all over me or getting in my way or whatever, how can I complain about you? You know, if you're a troll, you know, obviously the synchronicity of the fact that this is real time makes it easier because I can treat you more like a regular person. You can't just sit and kind of be mean to me at a distance in the way that you can in a forum. But there are still issues around, does the club owner let me complain about you?
Right.
How does that work? So that's something that we think is like a very important part of design, not just for us as a company to make these kinds of more public spaces work, like what we have here. We got people here, I don't know who they are. But we also need to, as an industry, I think, kind of solve some of these problems together because there are going to be standards that need to get created here. And you made me think of Black Mirror, you know, what's a standard for reputation? You know, if I'm giving you a negative or positive stroke, where's that stored? Is it stored on a blockchain? Is it stored in a database? Have you followed the thing coming out of China that's called Sesame? Talk about Black Mirror. Unbelievable.
Yeah, only very loosely, but not very closely. I mean, it's weird. It is a little weird, a little frightening too, because it makes you, for those in that region, likely concerned about what you're posting on social media or in your email inbox, which you assume to be private or you probably shouldn't assume it's private. But
what do you think the privacy, I mean, what are your thoughts seeing so many different products? You know, do you have thoughts about where you think sort of privacy is going to end up, I guess, as we go forward?
Yeah, I've thought a lot about privacy and also avatars as one form of kind of concealing privacy. So there's a company that I invested in super early stage called Facemoji. And are you familiar with it or seen it before?
Yeah, I believe I have seen that one.
Yeah.
So what are they doing?
Yeah, so they're doing a few things, but they have a few different insights and well, what they're building now is technology to create very emotive avatars. And so, you know, similar to what you see in Animoji, where the facial expression and the avatar that you create and express and share, it showcases your subtle emotions, like your smile, your eyebrow movements, and so on. And so they're building technology for that. And one of the use cases that they've identified is really targeting esports streamers. You have gamers who are putting their camera up and they're playing Fortnite or other games like that. And the problem is not only logistically in setting up a camera with good lighting and so on, but also for a lot of people, especially women, privacy is a major concern when it comes to streaming publicly on the internet to a bunch of gamers. There's unfortunately a lot of, you know, horror stories from women gamers. And the one use case and one value proposition from that is how do you enable them to still have that kind of fun and have that expressive kind of character, but do it through the veil of an avatar. And
that is such a great example. You're right. This example of women in gaming that are doing great work and are doing streaming and are doing commentaries and stuff, then getting chased around basically in their real selves. Right. Mm-hmm. I hadn't thought of that. I think that's a perfect example of where we think, you know, like these issues have got to be worked out. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're a gamer online, I want to be able to create a rich avatar identity for you that's persistent and provable. You know, you should be able to walk into a conference and say, hey, it's really me, that person. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there's no way it's okay to have your personal life and your physical address, for example, easily accessible to everybody that's watching. No way. Mm-hmm. Right? So you need a stable identity as an avatar that needs to be durable. You know, maybe it has a reputation and stuff, but it can't be tied back to your home address.
Yeah, yeah. There's also this interesting aspect of our expression on the internet has also become the way that we express ourselves has changed over the years on the internet. And, you know, it used to be emoticons were basically a hack to express emotion. Like the colon parentheses was a smiley face. And then we have, of course, like emojis rising in popularity. And then we have things like GIFs and then we have Bitmoji and things like that. And these are all basically getting to a higher fidelity form of expression on the internet. And now we're getting to the point where Animojis is, you know, an avatar that's very expressive and the next generation of sort of ways to express yourself. And once we get more into like a virtual world, it's like, how are we going to express ourselves as human? And how are we going to self-identify? Because the other aspect is that we already inherently kind of express ourselves in a different way on different networks. And so the way I communicate on LinkedIn might be different than Twitter, which might be different than Facebook, which is definitely different than a private Facebook like messenger group with three of my closest friends. And so it's interesting to consider, okay, if we all need some sort of form of representing ourselves, like in the form of an avatar, whether it looks like us or maybe it's the robot over there, it's kind of interesting to consider, like, how does that change the way that we long-term express ourselves?
If you talk differently when you're in different forums, and I know exactly what you mean, I mean, it's like a mm-hmm. dialect, right? It's like a dialectic difference. If we talk differently in different forums, do you suppose that when you're in VR and you're going to a live event versus talking to me here versus hanging out with, like, really close friends or family, what do you suspect you'll want to have change about your avatar? Like, how do you feel about this avatar?
Yeah.
Do you think you want to change it?
Yeah, I mean, I'd be curious to hear some of the data that you're seeing now. But like, if I look in this room, I see some people that look normal. I assume maybe that's what they actually look like, but it's a version of them. And then mm-hmm. I see, I don't know what that is, like some crazy cyborg man or woman.
That, I believe, is actually the Blue Power Ranger.
Is it? All right.
We did a wonderful, crazy kind of technical capabilities event that was a lot of fun with the Power Rangers when they did their film, where we had the principal actors just suited up like you, and they were on stage. And it was, to your point about identity, it was fascinating because they did a meet and greet that was, we had about 100, you know, super fans that came in and got into gear and everything. And so we had an event like this with them, and they were up on stage. And initially we had them as, I don't know if we built all their avatars or scanned them. I don't remember, but they were themselves, their real life selves. And then they switched into their Power Rangers suit.
Oh, that's right.
Totally awesome.
Yeah. So you see kind of a combination of people, you know, expressing themselves in a way that they couldn't in the real world. Like that's a robot there with pencil thin legs. And then we also see people probably as themselves. And so I think people will probably put on different suits and want to have fun in this type of world like you're seeing today.
One thing we saw that from Second Life that was really interesting, and I think it'll apply here, but let's find out. You know, we'll see over the coming months as we start to scale up. The choices that people make about identity in Second Life were surprisingly singular. Like, you would have thought that people, especially people that were hugely committed to their time there, you know, that were spending, you know, 5 hours a day in Second Life and were running a business there and had tons of friends there, you would think that they would have had more visual identities than they did. What actually happened over the years was that people were surprisingly focal on one identity. And I think that has something to do about with brain capacity. Like, I think we only have a certain amount of ability to imagine ourselves as different things. And I think there's a fatigue associated with like really being out there and creative and being like far away from how you imagine yourself. And so it drew people back to like a more single representation. Like, I had one avatar, which did not look like me. It is an iconic avatar now because I was the founder of Second Life, and it's Philip Linden. And that avatar, though, I never changed. Like, I kind of got stuck, you know, like I think it got burned into my head, and then I couldn't give it up. And it was even very nostalgic about it. And I've been trying to get it. I want somebody to make it here in high fidelity for me so that I can have my Philip Linden avatar really well done in high fidelity. So it's interesting. Yeah.
Stay tuned for a mini interview with Phil, co-founder of Carbon, a GE Ventures portfolio company that's created the groundbreaking new method of 3D printing inspired by the Terminator. For those looking for a new challenge, career change, or perhaps a higher salary, take a look at AngelList. If you're in tech, you probably have a profile on the site, but if not, it takes 2 minutes to set up and start browsing opportunities from hot startups. You can filter jobs by company size, maybe you prefer a smaller company as a founding employee, or market, like biotech, consumer tech, crypto, etc. My favorite feature, though, is transparent compensation, so you can see exactly how much companies are willing to pay for your talent. Take a look at angel.co/jobhunt.
Yeah, it's kind of like usernames. When you grow up on the internet as a kid, sometimes you make up some sort of maybe embarrassing username and it sticks with you.
Yeah.
And it becomes the username you on Twitter and your Gmail address. Like, my Gmail address is like, it's a variation of my middle name, but it's kind of like, it's not my preference right now, but I'm kind of stuck with it. Hard to switch.
Unique text strings like domain names seem to be this profound new human discovery, right? Yeah, I always rage against that. I don't really like account names. Maybe it's my age, you know? Like, I feel like the distinctive but weird full of numbers, you know, account name doesn't really do a lot for me, but it sure is an interesting kind of a stake in the ground or whatever.
Yeah.
Philip and Ryan, I just have a quick question from the live stream, and I think it might be an interesting topic about, you know, Ryan's hands look a little bit bent, and so maybe talk about... and yours look a little bit
that?
More natural, so I just want to maybe
because
interest.
I'm a practiced performer.
Yeah, you're a pro.
In VR. We were just talking about this before. If you guys look at Ryan's wrist, what's really happening is his elbows aren't there. When he's doing like that, his elbows are actually coming in. They're in front of his chest, but as an avatar, they're out there. So one of the things that we have to do is we have to guess at all the places where your limbs are that we don't have a tracker on. And as you guys have seen, for those who have followed us on other performances, sometimes we'll put our guests, like Ryan here, in these trackers that let us know where your chest, your shoulders, your feet are. And of course, that gives us more fidelity. We do that sometimes. But it still doesn't give us the elbows, for example. We still don't have everything. So there's this problem that we have to keep pushing on of putting our bodies kind of in the right place. So that's a good call from the audience. Is yes, Ryan's elbows, folks, are not where they really are.
It is kind of creepy. Yeah, when you're looking at your own thick hands and wrists, it is kind of creepy when you move them around like this because it doesn't feel.
The other thing is you can't wiggle your fingers. We can't talk with our hands like we want to. We can't wiggle our fingers yet. Obviously, that's because for those watching, you know, Ryan and I are both holding 5 Pro controllers. Which those controllers don't have like sensors that tell us where, if you're really clever and you very gently touch the little thing, I can do things like point my finger, but it really doesn't work very well. You lift your thumb up, your thumb's lift up, but it's not a very good system. And don't click on those buttons. You can teleport over there. You saw that, but
yeah,
it's not perfect yet. We need to be able to track the fingers and the eyes. We talked about that earlier. Mm-hmm. You know, you folks in the audience can't really see our eyes. For Ryan and I, it's pretty good, but we're not really able to see exactly where our eyes are. That's an important piece that's missing.
Right? Yeah.
All these things are going to have to happen. I do think they're going to happen in the next couple of years, though. So we're going to see there's a lot of technical progress that's been made. I think the next generations of products that come out for these headsets are going to be quite interesting. Companies that are working on them continue to make huge investments in hardware. Did you have another one, Ashley?
Yeah, I've got 2 follow-up questions. One is about computer vision technology. Can it be used for body movement tracking instead of placing sensors? And then what are the current status or issues of such efforts?
Well, basically the deal is on that, answering from my side, high fidelity. Yes, computer vision is getting better and better. The Leap motion devices that track your hands are an example of that. They track all the joints of your fingers very acutely. Just from a video feed, especially it's a binocular feed, but it's pretty much regular camera. Similarly, machine learning is being used to improve the ability of a regular camera to like decode all our joints. I do think that we're going to get to systems that allow us to track the joints of a person without having to have hardware on them. So that would be my gut. I think it's going to take another couple of years as that stuff gets worked out. But there's pretty good examples coming out of the lab. I think Microsoft has done some amazing work on that. Oculus has done some amazing work with camera-based tracking as well. So I think we'll see some stuff. Have you seen anything around that?
I'm not following it as closely as you are. I'm eager for some of this advancement to happen. And I've seen a lot of kind of video demos on Twitter, actually, people sharing different hacks and different ways of, if you even use an iPhone X, for example, to track and map like facial expressions to an avatar. There's a lot of really cool stuff happening, but it can't come fast enough, I feel like. As someone who loves playing with new technology and someone who can hopefully see like maybe what it might become through inspiration of books and movies and so on, who do you think, I don't know, if you fast forward, let's say 5 years, what does VR look like if you were to predict, paint a picture of what VR is in 2023?
Yeah, well, I think if you look at 5 years out, first of all, tech adoption cycles around broad consumer-facing technologies, I think, are best exemplified by the iPhone right now, which started in 2007, was not commonly used, even though there were certainly lots of people buying it. And then it got to sort of critical mass density, right? About, you know, 5 years later than that, you could see the writing on the wall. And now, 11 years later, it's at, well, the smartphone, you know, the copy, you know, the Android and the iPhone represent, you know, world domination, you know, with whatever, you know, 2 million or so handsets out there. I think VR will go through a similar, a little bit slower scale. So maybe we're on a a 10-year, so that, you know, that was like a 7-year, you know, driving all the way to the peak. I think mm-hmm. VR will be more like 10 because the early use cases are less obvious. It's not like everybody wants to get one of these headsets right now. Mm-hmm. So there's going to be a little bit of a rough road around defining things like learning applications that are going to really start pulling, you know, students into these headsets. But we know that the headsets are coming next year that are going to be worth simple standalone headsets that'll have 6 degrees of freedom and track your hands and everything. Mm-hmm. I think those are going to drive the beginning first wave of consumer adoption. So if you look like 5 years out, I think we'll still be like in the middle of that. It won't be a fait accompli yet, but we will have a lot of people make daily use of these things. And mm-hmm. I think we'll still see applications that are high value, like teaching, virtual travel, we talked about. Mm-hmm. I think we'll see like a lot of that going on to where it's starting to be really widely discussed as, you know, travel replacement, for example. People will say, oh my God, I don't have to go to a meeting anymore. I jump in one of these gadgets and mm-hmm. not take an airplane. So I think we'll start to see early impact there. I think we'll see experiments in entertainment having happened. You and I were talking about that.
Mm-hmm.
I think the fact that you can get, you know, a million people at a very progressive, you know, new indie kind of concert experience, you know, you have a million people in VR coming.
Yeah.
That's awesome. I mean, that there's got to be a game changer there. You know, we've been doing a lot of experiments, like putting DJs in head trackers and, you know, letting them do their work behind the stage and just playing with different ideas to try to find out what, you know, what the entertainment experience looks like. And I think mm-hmm. like next year, as we start to get consumers buying these things, we'll start to have some prototypical like music experiences that'll happen in here that'll mm-hmm. be quite amazing. So I think we'll by 5 years, we're going to see definitely a range of entertainment options as well that are being consumed by what are kind of mid adopters, I guess, to this stuff.
Yeah. Which company from the hardware side do you think is there going to be a major player? Is it going to be like Android and iOS? Do you think it'll be kind of a duopoly in that sense? Or how do you see that playing out longer term if you were to predict?
Yeah, you know, that's a really interesting question. Like, if you look at Apple and the iPhone, they had that lead because there were really significant, like, quality and ease of use aspects of the device that made their device really vastly superior for the mm-hmm. early adopters who had a little more money and could afford, you know, $700 for a phone or whatever. I think VR might look like that. So we might see, like, one company like an Apple or Oculus, you know, / Facebook, really doing a good job with the hardware. You know, we haven't seen mm-hmm. any really great hardware yet, but, you know, like Oculus with its Santa Cruz prototype, which is its standalone prototype that's supposed to come out. I think we're going to hear that it's going to come out in Q1 or something like that. I think that could be a device that's more of a breakthrough, you know, that has some really amazing features. I tend to think in the long term, it is going to be like Android in the sense that VR is going to be such a common public utility that there's mm-hmm. going to be tremendous competition to build devices. I don't think there's going to be like network lock-in to the degree that there maybe was with the early App Store. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's going to be more like a utility, like what, like USB or something. You know, you're going to go out mm-hmm. and be like, I need a really good headset. You know, I'm going to get the Bang & Olufsen one or whatever, you know. But I right. think there's hopefully going to be a lot of standards that will enable these things to be generally used across a lot of systems.
Yeah. What does it look like? We touched on this, but we didn't dive deep into it, but I'm sure everyone here has probably seen Ready Player One or at least read the book. And there's many different other sci-fi novels in that world.
Chorus of yeses.
Yes. You know, is a Ready Player One Oasis-like feature a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, I think it's a good thing, but it's funny you didn't see the reason why in the movie, which is so interesting. Yeah. Like, I think the book told the
story.
They
skipped over a lot of pieces, didn't they?
They skipped over the teaching. I mean, the simple idea, right? The reason that everybody was in the Oasis was that they kind of went there after school, right? And school, right, for everybody was done online. All the kids learned in headsets. So the question then, I guess, is that a good thing? Well, I think on by and large, it certainly is. First of all, when you're wearing headsets and hand controllers, there's a lot more physical mobility and, you know, fitness and balance that's going on here than mm-hmm. using a mouse and a keyboard or God forbid, a smartphone, right, you know, holding in front of you with your thumbs. So I think even the physicality of VR is like in a good direction. It's certainly not running around playing soccer, but it's not in a bad direction. So that's one thing. But the other thing that I think people forget is, my God, if I can go to school on a virtual planet where there are kids from all over the whole world, look at the human impact of that mm-hmm. versus me going to school with the kids that are within 10 blocks of my house. You know, there's a homogeneity to local to local places that is about mm-hmm. to get completely turned off with VR, which is such a great thing. I mean, if mm-hmm. I can go to school with kids in India, and they're in my class every day, I mean, that's going to change the whole world. So I think that the cultural benefit of being present, like we are right now in virtual spaces, like we are here with the gang that's here, but having those people be from all over the world is like a huge issue. When we do these big load tests, last Friday we did one where we had 350 people in the same space together. And I jumped down, I was stage diving, and I jumped down off the stage and I shake hands with people because that's how you kind of exchange cards and make friends here in High Fidelity. Mm-hmm. And I'm shaking hands with everybody and I ask them where they're from. And I mean, I got people from every continent that that are walking up to me. I had a whole bunch of people from Russia, different countries, from Belarus, Russia, and the Ukraine, all hanging out together, came up and shook hands with me. I never met them. And I mean, the impact of that, I think, the cultural impact of reducing distance with VR is like, kind of outweighs all the cons. Like, I'm okay with maybe, you know, not moving my butt as much during the day to have the benefit of being across the world in 100 milliseconds.
Yeah, I mean, there's the education piece you mentioned, but also work. Imagine if you thought a bit about the future of work and also the rise of distributed remote teams, and if we can reduce all the challenging aspects of working with a remote team through something like VR, and you could work anywhere, what does that do to quality of life? What does it do to real estate prices in San Francisco?
hopefully a good negative thing.
I mean, there's a lot of, essentially, if you could live on a beach in Thailand, you know, for $500 a month and live well, but work in San Francisco or for a SF-based company, like, what does that mean and how does that change other things? And so,
I think it's huge. I agree. I mean, for that, we just need to be able to read our email and needs, right? Which, as you know, I could bring up your email for you here on the little tablet, but you won't be able to read it comfortably. So I think that's one of the cases where, like you said, the change can't come quickly enough. We've got to get to readability of these displays. But, you know, the next generation displays, Google's already demonstrated, I think, about a 5K VR headset. And I mean, this is all coming very quickly. So once we can read our email and do like regular work in here, I think it's just going to be, like you say, it's going to be absolutely nuts. Why would I go to an office? If I can sit here next to my friend Brian and we both got our screens right here, I can turn to you and be like, hey, look at this. We're just, it's just a little more technology work, I think, to get to that. You know, right now we're kind of limited by the pixels.
That might be a good segue. We had another question from the live stream asking about, you know, the crossover between VR, AR, and MR, and outside of hardware, you know, besides emojis, what kind of crossover are we seeing between those industries?
Have you tried them magically?
I have not. Have you?
Yes, we have.
Cool. What are your thoughts on it? Is it, you know, of course, there's a lot of hype about it and a lot of interest, but
Well, Microsoft did some originally really groundbreaking work with the HoloLens that demonstrated. Most important thing for our industry was that they demonstrated the inside-out tracking, which is not what we're doing right now. You know, as you know, you and I are being scanned. You can even see me. I don't know if anybody else can see me glitching one frame once in a while, but basically what's happening here is that we've got these little, you know, laser projectors on the wall that are telling our headsets where they are, basically, in our hands. And that works pretty well. But what you really need is to have a headset that lets you walk through a park and continuously knows where it is. And Microsoft demonstrated that with a HoloLens, and I think that was one of the most amazing innovations. Magic Leap is, you know, not as much different from the HoloLens as everybody would have wanted. I don't think it represents a consumer breakthrough yet. I don't know that Magic Leap in this first incarnation intended it to be that. I don't think they did. But they do demonstrate a few interesting ideas, kind of more at the application layer. Like, they have a program on the Magic Leap that we were all just giggling about in the office because it's very much like High Fidelity, where you can pull stuff out of like a crate and just drop it on the floor, and you make a goldfish and it swims off around the room. I mean, and it knows where the edges of the walls are, so it won't go through the walls. I mean, that's pretty epic when you see that. But obviously the field of view and the weight and the you know, the battery life and everything is still just not where it needs to be for these devices to go mainstream. I think I think AR is hard because not only is the device development harder, you have to have a smaller, lighter, less obnoxious looking device, like we're talking about with spectacles and the glass. The other problem with AR, which is really, I don't know how to solve, is privacy and ownership. You know, like if I'm scanning the street as I'm walking around, and you walk by me and I sort of scan you with my device, like, can I just put that information about you into a database? And who owns that data? And so I think there, if I scan this room, not this room, if I scan a real room because I'm there for a meeting and it loads it up into some big global database of shapes or something, is that legal? You know, Do I sign something when I come into your office that says I won't scan your office with my gadget? So there's a lot of stuff that's going to happen around that. It's going to be big that needs to get worked out. So I think in short, I don't know what you think. I think AR is a bit farther out, and the focus on stuff like this, VR, is, I mean, you know, if we can go to school here, come on, let's get on it, go to school. I think there's a opportunity in the near term for that. But certainly AR is going to be very high impact as these technical and privacy issues get worked out.
Yeah. I mean, I think the I guess most mainstream, and I'm using quotes, which you can't see with my fingers here.
Yeah, you can't air quote.
Can't air quote yet. But the most mainstream adoption so far will be on mobile devices. And we've seen that. Mm-hmm. You could argue that Pokemon Go is not true AR, but, you know, it's a peek into that world. And there's a company called Ubiquiti 6, which, are you familiar with what they're doing?
I am not. Tell me about it. I've heard their name, but I don't. What do they do?
Yeah, so they have, I think, a beta of their app out right now, so it's not a full public launch, but they're basically creating technology in a way to simulate and layer on AR experiences in the real world with your mobile phone. And so they're starting off with, as most people in this field have like focused on gaming as kind of one sort of wedge into this space, is how do you create social, real-time, interactive AR experiences by using your phone in places like, they did a demo at the MoMA, the museum here not far away, and allowed you to recreate and put blocks in the physical world and look at those blocks that other people are also placing in real time.
Awesome.
Kind of like Minecraft.
Yeah.
So if you build a platform and a way for people and other developers to build on top of this kind of like AR mobile powered kind of experience, it creates a lot of interesting, I don't know, opportunities and use cases for other types of experiences.
I agree. I think
these are using the devices that are in your pocket, not, of course, these HTC headsets that we have on right now.
Yeah, exactly.
Or something
else. Just the moving window experience. Yeah, which is pretty. I agree. That idea of like doing Minecraft with other people in a shared space. I think if you ask me, like, what's a product we're going to see that we're all going to go, wow, that's super awesome. I think that product that uses the existing AR capability and lets you leave blocks around in the real world, you know, for other people to see, that's totally cool. There's got to be a there. There's got to be an amazing experience there. Yeah.
I think one illustration they were exploring is like Farmville for real life too.
Yeah.
So Farmville, of course, was a game that took off on Facebook and you could visit your friends' farms. But what if you could instead, as you're walking to work, see your friend's farm or plant or cow or I don't know, something that they've placed or interacted with? And how could you water those that plant or, I don't know, milk the cow in some way? Like, there's a lot of really weird, interesting opportunities once you start mixing location and AR together that are really compelling.
Yeah, and persistence, basically, which is the other requisite there. You know, it's that farm. I'm always fascinated by who's going to own the real estate in virtual New York.
Right.
Like, how in the heck is that going to work? Can I go into my competitor's store and buy the imaginary billboards on their wall and tell them to come to my store? I mean, silly nuts.
Or is it going to be like Monopoly? You know, people camp out and start owning real estate in the virtual world, and
totally right.
It starts to appreciate just like rent in San Francisco or real estate here in the city. A lot of interesting social questions to answer.
So many things. What an interesting time to be alive.
Yeah.
I was around for the first wave of the internet, and we thought that was absolutely bonkers. I mean, we were all like, this is the craziest thing we've ever seen. But now, this is way crazier.
Second Life started how long ago?
Well, I started the company in 1999 in Hayes Valley in San Francisco, but it took us about 4 years to really get it going. And then Second Life became like really well known in about 2006. But it's been a while. I mean, we're just
a lot of changes. 99
year. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's wild.
Yeah.
Something you guys just mentioned came up yesterday. We came across a group of people who were apparently kind of organizing, doing filming in a New York setting in the new New York domain. So they were doing acting and professional and everything. So it's kind of cool
to
see.
That's the high fidelity domain?
New York.
That's cool.
New York.
One of the technology things we're working on. So there's a couple of technology things that are really important about this stuff that admittedly, I will say, are as yet largely unsolved or are difficult problems. One is getting a lot of people in one space. I was mentioning we've been doing these load tests where we're kind of shooting for like 500 people in one space right now. That's kind of our big, you know, big wild goal. And we hope we can get there next month. And I would say for those listening on the live stream, if you want to come in and try out High Fidelity and be able to do this that we're doing, even if you have a desktop computer, you can join us. And in But on Saturday, October 6th, we're having another one of these crazy tests where you can come join us. We'll have some trivia, we'll have contests, prizes, all kinds of stuff. But basically, we're just trying to get as many people in one space as we can and kind of blow machines up. So that's one problem, is getting a lot of people in one space and then having it actually work in real time like what we're doing. The second problem, though, is huge spaces like New York. To actually like render a large space that's all editable by others is like still a pretty significant tech problem. It's one of the ones I'm really passionate about solving, and one of the ones that I hope we'll solve in the coming quarters. But I'd like to see like a New York scale, you know, thing that was built initially from like the Google data or something, but then it was totally edited by all of us. Imagine if you could spray paint on the walls.
Yeah.
Imagine if you could spray paint in New York, right? Just leave it in an alley and everybody comes and votes on it or something. I mean, that'd be like just absolutely super cool.
Yeah. Yeah. There's one of my favorite games as a kid was Grand Theft Auto San Andreas.
Totally.
And one of my favorite parts of that was I had only visited, I think, LA once. And so I didn't have a good perspective of the city and the terrain and everything. But I played that game and you could explore all of LA. It was basically a recreation of LA.
Yep.
And then years later, I went to LA and I was up in the mountains and I was like, this reminds me of that mission I took part in Grand Theft Auto as a kid. And, being able to do that, but for all parts of the world in a more immersive VR experience will be really compelling.
That is so
Philip,
true.
I do have one more question. Yeah. It says, I'm curious if they think that video and audio is the critical medium in AR and VR, or can they live independently? Pokemon was more video. Anchor is more audio. This is both.
Gosh, that's a thoughtful question. I'm not sure. I mean,
Do when they say independently, you mean be successful just as an audio platform without video or vice versa?
You know, just whether or not, you know, you can have, can, you know, audio be independent of AR and VR is how I'm reading the question.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we put a lot of thought into kind of the audio experience of VR and how that's really critical. So maybe it's kind of more talking about how that makes it a more powerful experience.
You know, my co-founder Ryan and I have often meditated on whether with 3D audio being really good like this, you could do some kind of an audio only world, you know, where we're all sort of, in fact, we do these load tests, and sometimes when we're doing the load tests, the way our servers work, we have a different server for audio and then a different one for video, basically. And sometimes we'll lose during the load test because we're crashing the servers, we'll lose like what we call the avatar mixer. And what happens is all the avatars disappear. So you disappear, I disappear. The room stays here, but we can hear each other. And it's like so trippy. It's like suddenly everybody's in the dark in a closet together or something. You know, you sort of hear everybody, and it creates this very interesting kind of acoustic, you know, intimacy. So I do wonder. I mean, it is possible that there's a there. You know, we're focused on sort of reproducing reality sufficiently well that we can do what we're doing now. Like that's kind of our hard target that we're after. But it is interesting to wonder whether there's a sort of a medium that's enabled by, particularly by 3D audio, which is such a different, you know, I won't get into it, but I could talk about it all day. But, you know, 3D audio is just a different thing in the brain than listening to a video.
I'm very fascinated by voice and audio technology, especially as people start to become more accustomed to wearing something like AirPods more often than they are today. And there's a company that Andrew Mason started a while back called Detour, which, you know, it's actually just it's audio-based tours. So if you visit a city, or maybe you're in your own city and you want to learn more about it, you put your headphones on or your AirPods and you just start walking around.
Yeah.
And it will start telling you things about the city and almost like a tour guide virtually. And I find that a really interesting use case of how you can use location data and audio to augment the way that you're seeing the world. And I think we'll see a lot more things like that.
That's such a great adaption to the technology as it exists today, because GPS will give you a good enough position fix to do audio. That's really interesting. But of course, GPS won't give you a good enough position fix yet to put the blocks, you know, like if I leave a block next to the bus stop to give you a message, you don't see it at the same place where I left it, because we don't yet have the ability to precisely position ourselves to within a few millimeters. I mean, people are working on it, but we don't have it yet. So yeah, that's like a really good example, just using audio to accommodate the fact that the GPS resolution is kind of low. That's
yeah.
Great. Well, this
cool. I've got one last question if you guys want it. It says Qt is a paid software, though it has a trial. So if high fidelity needs to be used in private domains, should a Qt license be procured?
Oh, no. No, absolutely not. Yeah, the Qt in the manner in which we're using it is open source. So you do not need a Qt license. High fidelity software is all Apache licensed open source. So our downloads of it are free to use in any way you care to, but you can also recompile it if you'd like. Build it for your own uses. But yeah, that's a great question. But to my knowledge, no, we've pretty aggressively tried to build ourselves to be like the web in that we believe open standards, open protocols, and open source software is going to dominate here. We think that what we're doing right now has got to be somehow akin to using a browser to log into a different site, you know? And so we've built our server software and our client software to basically be the same vision that we saw with like Mozilla and Apache. You know, in fact, we use the Apache license in our open source.
Interesting. Most companies wouldn't start that way.
Well, I think we've been ambitious. I mean, maybe we're too ambitious. I mean, if you ask me the question, you know, what can go wrong, Philip? I would say I'm early and I'm very ambitious about this stuff. And so we just kind of tried to take the Hail Mary of saying, we're not going to try to do software licensing. We're not even going to really bother too much with it. You know, people copying what we're doing. We're just going to say, look, if somebody else manages to do this stuff faster than us, get 1,000 people in a music concert, go for it. I'll find other ways to make money. I mean, but I think we're trying to do that work as quickly as we can. And, we've got a pretty good sized team and raised a good bit of money. So, you know, we should be able to keep working on this pretty quickly. This has been wonderful.
Yeah, well, this is
good
the first
to have you.
Yeah, first VR chat I've ever experienced. So
yeah, exactly.
Thanks for having me.
And there it is.
Yeah.
Good to have everybody here. Thanks for everybody who came on the live stream, and thank you, Ryan, for being here. This has been fantastic.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah, excited. Oh yeah, we got a dancing cat in the back. I love it.
All right, everybody. All right.
I'm here with Phil, co-founder and VP of Business Development at Carbon, a GE Ventures portfolio company that works at the intersection of hardware, software, and molecular science to create groundbreaking digital 3D manufacturing solutions.
Reading up on Carbon a little bit before this, I know there was some talk about the Terminator movie. What you're building is replicating some of the CG that we saw in that film decades ago. Is there some inspiration there, or is it just happened to kind of like the sci-fi that we've seen in movies just comes to be?
Very much so. The Terminator movie was definitely an inspiration. If you remember the scene where one of the Terminators actually grows out of the pool of liquid, we very much imagined a world where if we could make that a reality, we would have an opportunity to make things much faster than historically achievable, but also focus on creating structures and products not made possible before through traditional manufacturing methods.
How is it different than maybe 3D printers that people have seen today? What makes Carbon unique?
Historically, other 3D printing processes are layer by layer technologies. The technology that we are bringing to market is continuous. So it allows us to print much faster, allows us to print parts that are monolithic, that have better mechanical properties, and allows us to get into a deep well of chemistries that historically were unachievable in the additive space.
Is there a particular use case or product, maybe something tangible that you can describe that's using Carbon today? Maybe it's a product that people actually use and they don't even know it was possibly built with Carbon.
The largest user of 3D printers today is Adidas, all based on Carbon's digital light synthesis process. We partnered with them in 2016 to bring the first 3D printed shoe to market at mass scale. We've now delivered hundreds of thousands of these components going to millions a year. That was actually the most important moment in the history of 3D printing. For the first time ever, it was possible to make things not only at large scale in millions of units, but also make them economically. On top of that, deliver a product that was better performing than traditional manufacturing methods. A major point in time in the 30-year history of 3D printing. It was the thing that people had talked about since the 3D printer was first invented back in 1989 as what it could ultimately become.
How has GE Ventures been helpful to Carbon?
GE has been an investor and a huge supporter of Carbon from the early days. They participated in our 2016 Series C as well as followed on in our Series D in 2017. You may know GE is one of the folks in the forefront when it comes to digital manufacturing and big data. And we've learned a lot from them and have been hugely helpful in getting us into new markets as well as new opportunities.
This has been super interesting. Thanks, Phil, for coming in the show, and GE Ventures for making this interview possible. Check out ge.com/ventures to learn more about how they work with startups like Carbon. Thanks for tuning in. We'll be back next week. But in the meantime, share the podcast with your friends on Twitter and tag a guest you'd like to hear in a future episode. See you soon.